occupancy for a sufficient period of time for an accident to happen and tragically result in the death of Ms. Westmus.
Council, this pathway, there is an easement in favor of the public. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So Mrs. Westmus had a right to be there. This is not a matter of the property owner voluntarily opening up the property to the public, correct?
Once it became open to the public, yes. The public had a right to use it, even though it cut across the private property conference grounds.
Well, it became open to the public not by decision of the property owner, but by law, correct?
There is a path that crosses all around Lake Geneva, and property owners may decide whether to take part in that. This property owner did take part in it. It's beyond question, but that it was open to the public. Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Was it open then by the owner of this property? I know that's a bad use of the term since owner is particularly described, but is it so? It's your view that the fact that there's a public right here, that an agreement by the owner with the public is irrelevant. Is that right? I mean, you're not relying on.
We're not contesting that the plaintiff, as a member of the public,
right,
was indeed recreating on this path, cutting through the private property,
but
and she had a right to be there.
And could individual owners around Lake Geneva decide not to open their property to the public on this path, or do they have to do that?
Yes, presumably that would be their choice.
Okay. So the fact that this is an agreement with the public is irrelevant in this case. Treat it just as if she opened the land.
It's irrelevant in the sense it's undisputed that
right.
It was open.
Okay.
It
so
can be relevant for various analysis we might engage in today. But for sake of argument today, I don't think it cuts or has a bearing on the crucial issues before the justices.
Right.
And that is your opportunity today to reject the appeals court reasoning and adopt the trial court ruling that, in fact, Creekside was an agent and an occupant of this land by the very nature of its work, that being to maintain that trail at the contractual request of the owner. There was a direct relationship with the land in that sense. This court can harmonize the law of agent and occupant in a way that fulfills the purpose of the statute and the legislative intent, and that is to open and keep the land open by means of maintenance, the property for recreational pursuits like hiking. All of these words are built in to the statute itself. There is no question that the deceased and her son were hiking. There is no question that the legislature felt that public recreation is a value of the citizens of this state, and that there should be a balance struck between the property interests of various private landowners and the great public interest for health and tourism and whatever other considerations the legislature had in mind to using such lands.
Counsel, your opposing counsel advances that because Creekside is not an agent in the first instance, that its connection to the land is irrelevant. Could you respond to that, please?
Yes. The respondent in this matter attempts to strictly define and limit the scope of the word agent in a fashion that has not been employed by this court, in a fashion that is not contemplated by the legislature, and in fact in a way that doesn't even coincide with the plaintiff's own citations. I use the word plaintiff, of course, to refer to Westmus as respondent. Linville is cited for that proposition, Justice Bradley. In fact, Linville does connote an agency definition as whether or not the agent is connected to the land. In Linville, of course, the decision was that the EMT's services at that pond were not connected to the land. And other decisions have so decided as well. Those facts are completely different than ours. The entire purpose of Creekside and being on this land was to be connected to it. Indeed, the tree was growing on the very pathway or immediately adjacent to it in such a fashion that the agency definition is readily met by virtue of the connection to the land. So the entire purpose of Creekside and being there was for the land. The entire permission that it had, contractual, was to maintain the land, which is exactly in line with the legislature's idea to grant immunity, and the possession of it for that period of time necessary to fulfill this contract and maintain the trail was met as well.
Counsel, your position, if I understand correctly, is both that you were an agent of the owner and an owner by virtue of being an occupant. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is it possible to be simultaneously an agent of the owner and the owner?
Well, by statutory definition, of course, an agent becomes the owner. But yes, indeed.
Do all agents become owners?
By definition, under the statute, it's our contention that owner is defined as agents and occupiers.
Okay. If that's the case, then I'm wondering if there's a difference between an occupant and therefore an owner and someone who is simply lawfully on the property.
Yes, there can be a difference. And indeed, the courts have attempted to strike that difference. Someone lawfully on the property speaks to that person recreating and their status. They're lawfully on the property. Another individual might be properly on the property as an occupant. The snowmobile clubs, for example, are occupants lawfully on the property. So there can be a distinction depending upon the status of the person's presence on the property. What we advocate in this case is that there's a symmetry, there's a balance, there's a harmony, and a consistent approach to both occupant and agent that this court hasn't seen before, but that surely calls for the justices in this matter to bring those disparate elements, sometimes disparate, into a coherent understanding of agent and occupant, because Creekside meets both. By virtue of the very purpose of Creekside being there, it was to further the owner's desire to beautify the path, to make it safe, and to, in this particular instance, make sure that the path was not blocked by falling tree limbs or made hazardous for the public in using that path.
So when you addressed the issue of occupier, you went to the Lindell case. Yet when you raised the issue of immunity here, you initially raised it as agent and only subsequently brought in, as I read the record, brought in occupier after you said you saw the Roberts case. So what is it about the Roberts case that makes you, not Lindell, but Roberts, that makes you think, that caused you to, in your motion for summary judgment, to amend your motion for summary judgment to also bring in the occupier argument?
The Roberts case, having been decided at the appeals court level, I believe shortly before the summary judgment motion, did bring to our attention the occupancy standard. We did raise it before the trial court. The trial court did consider it. The trial court did give the opportunity to opposing counsel to address it.
And then we reversed that.
And then it was addressed. It was consistent with the held case, as the trial court observed, and a body of case law on occupancy. So the long answer, shortened to your question, Justice Bradley, is that in order to have a full record made and have all the law considered, by agreement of counsel and invitation of the court, occupancy was considered then.
I don't know if it was agreement by counsel. As I read it, there was an objection to your late filing 1 week before the hearing to add occupancy, and then the court
decided.
There was
indeed.
Yeah, so.
And time and opportunity given.
Yeah.
So, yes, it, given the recent publication of the Roberts Appellate Court decision, it did come to the trial court's attention in the fashion that it did. I hope that, despite some chiding by the appeals court and the timing of it, that this court will now consider the full opportunity to look at both occupancy and agency, and in a way that we advocate, to bring the two together under the facts of this case, which aren't similar in some respects to the other cases that you've decided, but most similar to the snowmobile cases. And it is surprising, I might say, that this kind of a decision hasn't been made before, because the service providers to various owners and that relationship is a very common one.
On your occupier argument, you take issue with the permanency analysis. And it is a matter of where you draw the line, I guess. It seems to me, when you look at the Roberts case and the discussion of some degree of permanency, that that was an element that was considered and relied upon by the majority. But here, not so much from your perspective.
Yes. These cases are often thought to be fact-dependent, and it's a matter of degree.
And you advanced that, I mean, right from the beginning in your brief, if I recall, shortly.
Yes.
It's a matter of fact-intensive inquiry.
And we're comfortable with those facts and that degree. Do we take issue, you ask, with the permanency rationale?
That's okay. You can chide me.
we feel, first of all, the Creekside meets the test. It was adopted in the court's Roberts decision. It was discussed. It is met, according to the trial court's rationale, by virtue of the fact that Creekside was there long enough to do its job. Permanency, time of possession can be variable under Doan, or time not relevant at all. So the scope of our contract called for limited cutting at different places, and we're there for that sufficient length of time to constitute compliance with the permanent test, as recently brought out. Remember that the degree of permanence, if we finish that definition, reads as opposed to mere use. So it isn't mere permanence, but it's as opposed to mere use. And when we fully consider that definition, surely Creekside wasn't a mere user and wasn't there incidentally. Creekside wasn't there as a sponsor or an organizer.
If they had been there one half day, does that alter your argument?
No.
How about 30 minutes?
No.
It'd still be an occupier.
Yes.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. You may continue unless you're finished. This contract was for 8 months for 2 years, if I read it right. Is that right? April 1, 2009 to November 15, 2009. Mm-hmm. And then April 1, 2010 to November 15th, 2010. Is that the contract we're talking about?
I recall Exhibit 10. It was a contract of that, in that fashion, yes, Your Honor.
But it doesn't say how long you spent in working those 8 months?
No, it does
and
not.
And that's not in the record, I assume.
It's correct. That degree of specificity was not called out in the proposal that constituted the contract.
So if I just looked at the length of the contract, I might say, hey, permanent enough for this purpose. Is that your position?
Yes, enough for the purpose it was there, enough to fulfill the contract and the permission we had to possess the land. It all goes back to the land. So the fulfillment of the contract, whatever its duration or other intended scope, was fulfilled for this particular purpose, to take down this limb on this dead tree at that location adjacent to the public path on the private property.
Now, counsel, your client's first argument for immunity runs to agency, right?
I contend that they come together, agent and occupant, but we can take it whatever order.
Okay, so say agency, but my review of the record indicates that your client had pretty broad discretion as to how it was going to complete the task. Yes, the conference center, the conference point, did deliver a list of tasks, and it included, in fact, what to do with the wood that was cut down. But other than that, your client was, it seems to me, and I stand to be corrected, but it seems to me your client was given a pretty free rein over how it was going to accomplish the tasks and under what circumstances, and I'm trying to fit that into my concept of what used to be, and perhaps anachronistically used to be called, the agent-master relationship. And the reason I say that is because that points to the rather tight control that had traditionally been expected of an agency relationship. So I'm trying. How do you reconcile the claim of immunity through agency with the relatively free hand that your client received from the conference center?
We don't find it inconsistent.
I'm sorry?
We do not find an inconsistency.
Okay.
First, the legislature, we all know, didn't define agent. And therefore, the broad purposes and the liberal interpretation to be given to the statute, according to the intent, should be abided by. Agent, as used in the statute, can have the ARSAN definition, which merely means to act on behalf of another, and need not include the kind of strict control implied by the servant aspect of agency. So agency can include independent contractors.
Right. So agency includes both the master-servant's relationship and the independent contractor relationship.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
The respondent would have this court graft on new law and strictly interpret agent to mean a servant. We contend that's erroneous. Not only does the statute already speak to employees and it calls for a redundancy, but it wars with the broad interpretation of the words that should be applied.
Yeah, I want to look at another word for potential redundancy. So you say that all agents become occupiers of the property and therefore owners. I presume that you would say that occupant is a term broader than agent, though, correct?
Yes, it can be.
Okay. So what would occupant include that agent does not?
I think to the cases that have come before the court, and it's hard to draw that line, of course. The Koski case spoke of the fireworks personnel as being agents, yet they didn't occupy the land. There was a certain occupation of the land by the motorist in the Snow Eagles case, who was not party to the recreational immunity argument. It certainly wouldn't constitute an agency relationship whatsoever and was never argued that way. The Linville decision, while the EMTs were occupying the pond to do their service and were probably agents, there's a distinction there. It's hard to draw the line, and in some sense, Creekside has the luxury of saying that the justices in this matter don't have to either, in that there's an identity between the status of agent and occupant, in that in furtherance of this contractual duty, Creekside was there as both.
Counsel, are you done?
Yeah.
You indicated that an occupier can be, as here, let's say Creekside, if they occupied for only 30 minutes, they would be an occupier under the statute. Now, the word occupier is only important because it statutorily makes an occupier an owner. It seems incongruous to me that the legislature would say that someone who was on the property for 30 minutes is an owner. And that's what your argument is advancing. Can you push back on that, please?
Sure. As applied, I hope the court isn't too troubled by that. As applied to the facts that tend to come before this court, it's not an unusual situation that there's a fairly transient or temporary relation to the land. I believe it was the Milton case where the snowmobile club was on the land for just long enough to put up the rail that the unfortunate rider ran into and got injured. I'll address the court's question. Commonly, the presence on the land is for a short period of time. There have been other cases before the court, especially the snowmobile cases, where that's been true.
Well, but in Held, your opposing counsel will say, look, Held was the full season. They had, it was a group that maintained the snowmobile paths. They had control of when they came to take care and maintain the snowmobile routes and when they didn't have to, and it was for a full season. So that's a little bit different than 30 minutes.
It might be, but we would consider that on summary judgment as a fact, maybe disputed perhaps, but not material. Because in Held, for example, that drag, as they call it, or that sled, was no doubt just left there after only the briefest interaction. The fact that the snowmobile club came back for other purposes on other dates was incidental and not material to the issues before the court. The fact is that in Held or Milton or any other such situation, the occupant is there for that period of time necessary to complete the task to fulfill the owner's objective. And so, too, it was with Creekside.
Can you think of any example where Creekside would be held liable?
Under the recreational immunity statute, if it acted maliciously, those are the exceptions, essentially.
So they could be negligent. They could come in and not even meet the standards in the industry with respect to how they cut down trees, and people get injured. They could be cutting trees while people are, you know, going through, picking the busiest time of the day, knowing people are walking through, not taking any precautions, and they could be shielded by recreational immunity.
Yes, it is the nature of immunity and the choices drawn by the legislature that sometimes war with our own views of whether it's fair or whether it's appropriate. But that is the choice drawn by the legislature, and yes, in all cases involving immunity, there is either probable or likely or questionable negligence. And yes, there was a tragedy here. So that indeed does happen, and that's the choice. I might add that plaintiff's entire theory is that Creekside negligently opened this space that it occupied for the public to walk through on that path.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Tindall?
Morning. I'm addressing the issue of agent, and Attorney Doosting will be addressing the issue of occupancy. We split the time 50-50, but if the court's questions require a different accommodation, we're more than happy to do that. I did want to point out a couple of things. First of all, the contract, Your Honor, that you referenced, that was Creekside Landscaping, not Creekside Tree Service. That was an entirely different entity. This contract is Exhibit 10 to the Gosrud.
So what does this contract say?
It says we will do these eight or ten tasks, and there's no specified time, as I recollect.
Not limited to 1 year or 2 years?
No. This project took 4 days, including the delay that occurred with this accident.
Was it renewed?
No. This was a one-time thing.
One-time contract for what time period?
It was not specified. So what happened here was Creekside Landscaping, an entirely different...
I've only looked at the appendix. I haven't looked at any separate documents. So where is it in the appendix?
So the Creekside Landscaping contract will be found in the appendix at 71.
Okay.
And also at 70 is another Creekside Landscaping contract.
With this...
That's not the contract in issue. That's not the entity in issue. Our contract is at 74.
Okay.
And 75. It's eight...
Okay.
Eight listed things. There's no specific time specified for when that would be done or how long it would take. It's a time...
That was in February 2012, right?
February 7, 2012.
All right. And what was the total amount of this? Five, six?
Roughly $17,000 is my...
Which is roughly the same amount of money from the contract I read.
But that was for the Creekside Landscaping. It's a separate entity, it's not related to this contract.
I understand, but it's for the approximately the same amount of money.
It appears to be for approximately the same amount of money.
And this has no... was this signed, ultimately?
My understanding is that it was accepted and was paid. I don't know that there's a signed copy in existence.
Okay.
But there was no time specified. This is not a lengthy... ongoing contract. This is a one-time thing. That Creekside had, or Conference Point had been given a gift by a donor to do, they wanted a better view of the lake. And so they were given a gift by a donor and they used it to hire tree trimmers. The first tree trimmer quit and then Creekside was hired to finish the job after the first one quit. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Gosrud's testimony was that this whole contract, number 10, was not actually performed because a lot of the money for the project had been used up on the first contractor who quit, and so they had to cut the job to so that it would match the money they had.
So some of this work was not on the open path, the public
Correct.
Path. It looks like the East Shoreline might be on the open path.
It's not
specific as to which.
So it was on both properties that the initial contract was for tree trimming that was considered, and multiple contractors came in to bid on it, and they submitted. Another point I wanted to clear up was Conference Point did not say, "Here's our list of things we want you to do." They brought in the tree trimmers and said, "We have this money and we want to trim these trees over around in this area," and then the different contractors submitted their list of what they thought the work should be, and this would be Creekside. Exhibit 10 is Creekside's list of the work that it proposed to do that ultimately essentially was accepted, but not fully because there wasn't that much money left.
Okay, now agency.
Agency. Well, first I wanted to point out three errors in the reply brief related to agency. First, they cite to Myers for this broad definition of agency and say that it cites to the restatement second of agency. It cites to the first restatement of agency,
Counsel, instead of getting down into those weeds, let's start a little higher up. Does the concept of agency include both the master-servant relationship and independent contractor?
No, and that's what the arson case, arson case makes clear.
Hang on a second. Yeah, let me just rephrase this then. As a general matter of agency law, does that cover both the master-servant relationship and the independent contractor relationship?
No. Arson specifically says, page 52, an independent contractor may or may not be an agent. It even cites the jury instruction 6040, which says an independent contractor may or may not be an agent. So in contrary to what Creekside is arguing, an independent contractor is not always an agent.
So what distinguishes between when an independent contractor is and is not?
Well, in Arsan, citing the second restatement, they said a house, they gave an example, and it's essentially the control test that we've discussed, and they said a house builder who stipulates to build a house for a price is an independent contractor but not an agent because it's not a fiduciary, it can't bind the owner of the property, and the owner of the property doesn't have the right to control what it does.
In this case, the owner of the property does have the right to control how the trees were trimmed, right?
No. They simply hired, they said, these are what, this is what we like done.
Hang on a second. I want to make sure I get your answer correct there. And I want to make a distinction between did they control versus did they have the right to control. And you just told me they did not have the right to control how they trimmed the trees.
No, there was... Creekside was the party with expertise regarding tree trimming, and it was the one that identified the trees to be cut, chose the methods and materials for how to do it, and was the one in control of the methodology and the personnel and everything.
So your position is that Conference Point could not have wandered down, an employee of Conference Point could not have wandered down to where Creekside was active and say, hey, you know what? I decided don't cut that tree and don't cut that branch and do it tomorrow. They couldn't do that?
Well, there was nobody at Conference Point who was appointed to do any such thing.
I'm sorry, that's not my question. Did they have the right to do that? If they chose to do it, did they have the right to tell them, don't cut that tree, don't cut that branch, and do it tomorrow?
There's no indication in the record that Conference Point had that right.
And are you honestly suggesting to me that when an organization hires someone to do something for them, they lose all control over what that person does?
If you've got a contract that says this is what you're to do and you sign the contract, you don't get to come in and say, you know what, I've changed my mind and I want a different countertop without having to change the counter, or the contract. I mean, the contract specifies what the job is to be.
And so if once that contract was executed and someone from Conference Point did wander down and say, don't cut down that tree, Creekside could have said, forget your directions, I'm cutting that tree.
Well, if it was like any other contractors, that's the contract is what specifies the rights between the parties. And nothing in this contract specifies, I mean, they signed a contract for essentially particular work. It wasn't as specific as all that because in some areas it said cut down slimmer trees or okay. But
I want to make, because you know I think this is an important point and I want to make sure you're comfortable with your position that Conference Point lost the right to tell Creekside which trees or which limbs to cut.
Conference Point did not have, as I understand their agreement, it was the contractor which specified which trees. Conference Point specified the general area. And once the contract was executed, it's my understanding that the contract is the contract, and you would have to change it as you would any other contract.
And that's your final answer?
My final answer. And as any other contract, can you fire? Say Conference Point said, you're doing a cruddy job. We don't like this. You're fired. I think they could fire them, but that's not the type of control that one that grants one a master-servant type of relationship that creates an independent contractor into an agent.
Counsel, I hear by this questioning this. that rather than what some would advance are the traditional indicia of agency, the means and method, who has control of the means and method of a project that's undertaken, that instead the test is who has the right to control, not whether or not they did, whether the record reflects they did control. Assume that the record, as the Court of Appeals found here, that, or determined here, that the conference point only gave the vision and the concept, but in paragraph 18 it says, but left the means and methods up to Creekside. So assume these facts, but address the question, if you will, who cares if they left the means and methods up to Creekside? As long as they have the right to control, that's the important focus of agency analysis.
Typically, that's the shorthand analysis. If you, did they have the right to control? The details of the work is the way that it's typically phrased. And but if you look at the restatement and you look at, say, Arsand quoting the restatement, there's a number of things. Who provided the materials, what, you know, that are subsets. But it's typically given as a shorthand analysis to say who had the right to control the details of the work. And here that was Creekside, not Conference Point.
Why did you make a distinction between Restatement 1 being cited and Restatement 2?
Simply because Restatement 1 didn't, it was older. It was just a short quote out of it. But Restatement 2 was quoted in the more recent case, Arsand, and it specifically says, and this is repeated in any number of cases here, an independent contractor is not always an agent. They have to meet that control test that's typically applied in order for them to be an agent of the person that hires them. And that should be the test here as well. And another issue was the statute defines owner to include occupiers, but not agents. It says that owners and their agents and employees and officers have no duty to do certain things and have no liability, but it doesn't define an agent as an owner. So that's a quibble, I suppose, mm-hmm.
Counsel, at page 43 of your brief, you suggest that we can treat the terms agent and employee as being indistinguishable, correct?
No. I mean, the argument of the petitioner is that if an agent has to be a servant, that means that then the term employee might as well be read out of the statute. But Arsand says that a servant can be an employee, but it doesn't have to be. An independent contractor can be a servant and not an employee, but it depends on the facts and circumstances of each case. And in this case, we think they're not met. But there's no agent or servant and employee are not the same. You don't have to be an employee to be a servant.
You say in page 43, further support for the appellate court's decision is found in cases discussing agents under section 895.52 and treating the terms agent and employee as indistinguishable.
Oh. Hmm? No, there's no case that defines agent and says here's who is an agent for purposes of the statute. The Worth case and the Kosky case use the term agent and employee. They use both terms. In Kosky's case, I think they were volunteers, I can't recall. In Worth, they were employees, but the court in deciding the case used the term agents and employees as if they meant the same thing.
And we can't do that, can we?
Well, I think that in Arsand, the court said, we've used the term agent, independent contractor, and servant inconsistently, and that's led to confusion. So to avoid confusion, it would be best not to conflate the terms because they don't mean the same thing. And in declaring that to be an agent, you must be a servant, as in any other context, does not thwart the purpose of the statute, But doesn't mean that you have to be an employee either. It doesn't conflate those terms.
Right. So agent and employee must mean separate things because our statute uses them and says that agents share with the owner's immunity, as do the employees.
Correct.
So employees are generally considered to be the typical master-servant relationship.
Correct.
And that's where the master has the right to control the details of the employee's work. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So obviously, I think, the statute means something broader than that, because an agent is not necessarily an employee, because we use both terms in the statute. And so it must mean that an agent shares with the owner's immunity when the owner does not have the right to control the details of the agent's work.
That does not hold true. My red light is on, if I may answer the question. That does not hold true, because you can have an agent who you have the right to control the details of their work, an independent contractor who can be your agent, you have the right to control the details of their work, who is not an employee, but that doesn't necessarily mean that an independent contractor whose right to control, who you do not have the right to control, would qualify as an agent. And the Kettner case on page, can't read my writing. The Kettner case's analysis, 736, 735, explains why that it makes sense to limit immunity to a servant where immunity is granted to protect. In Kettner, the court said, 893-80's purpose is to protect the government and taxpayers by limiting their exposure to liability, and the protections necessary include granting servants immunity too, because their conduct can be imputed to the principal and make the principal liable. So in order for the principal to get that immunity desired by the statute, then the persons whose conduct may be imputed to them should also be immune. And the same thing holds true with this situation. In order for the landowners to get the immunity desired by the legislature, then people whose conduct can be imputed to them should also be included as their agents. But if their conduct has no impact on the landowner's liability, then it doesn't further the purpose of the statute, and it does not warrant immunity for the party who is not an agent, as that term is used throughout our case law.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. I think one of the most important things that we have to focus on is that, as this court has stated on many prior occasions, in cases involving the interpretation of a statute, the primary objective is to ascertain and give effect to the intent of the legislature. And because this issue has come before the court fairly recently, this year in the Roberts case, we all know this, but it bears repeating that the purpose of this statute is to encourage owners to open their land for recreational use. That encouragement comes in the form of limiting liability to owners where the owner does not derive more than a minimal pecuniary benefit. At the very heart of this case, Creekside has no control or any influence, for that matter, whether the shore path around Geneva Lake is open and available for the public's use. And importantly, for Creekside, this was a one-time job based on a proposal that they submitted for pay, for profit.
Why does it matter that they're being paid for it?
Why does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the question?
Yes.
Because within the very stated purpose by the legislature, it's to be used or awarded in situations where the owner derives no more than a pecuniary benefit. And the reason it's important
and the owner here is not deriving any pecuniary benefit from Creekside doing the tree trimming, right?
Right. Okay. Well, my belief is that the statute in this case is meant to encourage Conference Point. And whether Conference Point had the ability to open or close the path is not very clear from this record. But
okay. But I still want to figure out why it is you point to compensation as being something relevant to the analysis.
Well, if the petitioners, and I'm not sure I heard this articulated, but if the petitioners' position is they are the ones that the legislature is intending to encourage, and I don't think that's the case, but if that's part of their position, they're the ones who received a pecuniary benefit for being on the property in the first instance.
Well, if the tree trimming was done by a Conference Point employee, would the employee be immune?
Conference Point employee?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. He gets paid.
Well, he gets paid as part of his employment.
Right. So he's being paid to cut the trees. Why is it okay for him to be paid to cut the trees and get immunity, but because Creekside gets paid to cut the trees, it doesn't get immunity?
We maybe don't even have to get to that point, because if this statute is intended to encourage those who have the opportunity and the influence and the control over whether the property is open in the first place, then we don't even really need to get to that second factor of pay, because...
Well, I think we might, because the statute is, by its own terms, broader than encouraging the owner to open it, right? The immunity extends to employees and agents of the owner as well. And presumably, the agents have nothing to do with opening the property to the public.
Well, to the extent that Creekside asserts itself as an agent of Conference Point, in this case, they don't. So occupiers is part of what the statute defines as an owner. But what we haven't talked about today is that just this year, in the Roberts case, this court gave us a definition of owner. And I shouldn't say gave us the definition.
Let's just get back to the employee. If you made the employee liable, then there'd be vicarious liability for the employer who's the owner here.
Right. If
that violates the statute.
Right. Exactly. If it's a Conference Point employee who negligently cut down a limb that killed somebody, then the lawsuit would be brought against the employee in Conference Point. So,
and of course, at that point, Conference Point would assert its immunity, and then the employee would be there and be liable.
I don't know that as a practical matter, as it relates to the rules of vicarious liability, if an employer could say that we're out under the grounds of 895.52, but I'm sorry, unfortunately, their employee remains in because they're not entitled to it.
But it appears the legislature thought that was necessary because they exempted from liability both the owner and its employees.
Right. So you're getting back to your question, is why does it matter that Creekside was paid?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it doesn't, and that's my point. Maybe we don't need to even get that far because they're not the party who this statute is intended to encourage.
Well, ordinarily, if people perform a service and get paid for it, they have an obligation to do the job well. And then since they've made money on it, and if they don't do it well, either by injuring somebody or by not performing the contract well, they're liable. That's the general rule. That's why you look to see whether they're being paid versus they're being a volunteer, which may bring in different rules, or that they are, and the statute takes care of this, nonprofits.
Well, I agree, and we disagree vehemently with the petitioners who in their brief say this case mirrors the snowmobile cases that have come before our courts. And there's a variety of reasons why this case really doesn't even come close.
Why not? The snowmobilers trim different things, but their job is to maintain the alleyway for the public, right?
Right.
And that's what Creekside was hired to do.
Well, here's the difference. There's three distinct differences between the snowmobile clubs or the trail associations than Creekside in this case. Number one, each and every defendant in those cases, and you can look at Held and Lew and Milton, those were all nonprofit organizations. They were not a business doing these tasks as part of their business for a profit motive. But number two, in each of those cases, the snowmobile clubs had an ongoing relationship with the property. Counsel for the petitioner said that, well, look at Milton. They were there long, there just long enough to open the trail. But I encourage the court to take a closer look at Milton. Milton involved an access gate to which the snowmobile club held the key. They had the actual key that determined whether access to the recreational property was open. But back to the ongoing nature of the relationship, the reason why the snowmobile clubs, in my view, were deemed to be occupiers is because they didn't just come in and build the trail and then get out. These were snowmobile clubs that had an interest in furthering Wisconsin's entire snowmobile trail system. And so they not only constructed the trails, but they had an ongoing obligation, even self-imposed obligation, to groom the trails and maintain the trails. And if you look at some of the facts of those cases, they even cut the grass, which presumably didn't happen during snowmobiling season. So the point is that they had an ongoing relationship. And the difference is that those clubs treated that property as if it were its own. And that's why those clubs are more akin to owners.
But it wasn't their own, right?
I'm sorry?
It was not their own.
They were not legal title holders to the land.
And they were not constantly there. Their presence on the property was transient. Right?
That
they'd come in and they'd maintain and then they would leave.
No doubt about it. But that's why using the term degree of permanence is a good one in determining the extent to which the entity has a true possessory interest in the land. The definition is to take and hold possession. And so under the facts as you describe them, they're not always there. They're not taking tickets and each and every day monitoring ingress and egress. But the reason why they could be deemed to have taken and held possession is because they had an ongoing possessory interest in the property.
Suppose this was the 2-year contract that I opened up with, and you had 2 contracts for 8 months each, and there was an option for a 3rd year. Would that change your argument?
Well, I think that would put them closer to the snowmobile club situation. So if this was, I don't want to change their name, but if this was Creekside Trail Club, and what they had here was an arrangement whereby their goal was to do things to make sure the shore path remained open. And on an ongoing basis, they swept the trail and they cleaned it off and so on. Then there'd be an argument.
5-year contract.
Well, is the question, what if they had a 5-year contract? Mm-hmm. Sure. I don't think that when we talk about degree of permanence, we have to necessarily establish that it is a contract or an agreement for life into perpetuity. So a degree of permanence doesn't really lend itself to a finite period of time, but I think it's a good factor in the overall evaluation of what's the relationship between the actor and the land.
Where in the statute, in the text of the statute, is there any reference to temporal requirements or limits?
I'm not aware of any.
Has the case law, have the courts just made it up as we've gone along?
Well, you know, this court has said on many occasions, and I, going on 30 years, that this statute needs some repair. And so, you know, lawyers and judges have struggled with this statute because of the myriad of fact patterns that where it touches. So have courts just made up a temporal element. And are you asking, have courts made up the concept of degree of permanence? I'm aware of where it came from originally, which is a New Jersey court, which then was adopted by the Seventh Circuit. But since that time, courts have used it. These courts have used it, most recently in Roberts.
But how are we to know where to draw the line?
Well, I don't think that degree of permanence fits very well in the event cases, and that's where the question about degree of permanence has come up most often. What if the Lions Club puts on this event for a day or 2 days? I don't think that's the greatest way to use this as a factor. But in a case like this, where we're talking about ongoing or maybe not ongoing relationship with the land, I don't think you can put a specified time frame on it. I think Justice Abramson's question, 5 years or four.
Well, the degree of permanence is an attempt to at least partially define a statutory word of occupy. Now, suppose I went on the land and I'm on the path, and that's perfectly valid because it's open to me as part of the public, and I see a branch hanging. And I decide, while I'm on the land, I'm going to help this by getting rid of that hanging branch, which looks dangerous to me. Yeah. And I yank it down, hit this poor woman, and kill her. So if I'm an occupier of this land, and I am on recreation, I am immune. Under the statute, we have to define whether I'm the kind of occupier that this statute intended, right? Because I'm negligent and therefore might be liable.
Right. I would challenge you as being an occupier under those circumstances. The definition is take and hold possession. Treat the property as if it were your own.
I sure did. I was there for 5 hours. And man, I picked all the poison ivy and all the other weeds that are bad and noxious and trimmed the trees, and I occupied that land. And nobody's suing me for trespass, and nobody's claiming that I shouldn't have done any of that. I mean, the owners, as we define legal title, are not after me. So if I look at the dictionary definition of occupy, what do I find is the dictionary definition? This court's very fond of the dictionaries.
Right. Well, I thought that's what the Roberts Court used, which actually came from the Doan case, which is to take and hold possession. It means having some control over the property.
Couldn't we look at this in a more functional way and say that an occupant of the property is someone who is there at the request of the owner and for purposes that the owner would otherwise be exercising?
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I was distracted by my red light. So can we look at this in a way where so long as the actor is there at the behest of the owner?
And is doing things that the owner would otherwise have to do himself.
No, and I think that's where, with all due respect, I think the petitioner misses the point when it comes to their argument that they're doing some work on the land. Because Linville tells us that even undisputed property owners who are not doing something related to the condition of the land are not entitled to immunity.
But they're doing, obviously, stuff that was related to the land here.
We don't dispute that, but that doesn't make them occupiers because they're not taking and holding possession. They don't have a possessory interest. Just because the true property owner says to Creekside, you can be here and you can do these things, doesn't make Creekside as one who holds a possessory interest.
Thank you, counsel.
Your co-counsel said that they had the right to
Justice
be there to
Kelly,
cut down whatever trees they wanted.
His red light is on. I'm going to ask you to sit down, please.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, counsel, page 36 of your brief. I'm sorry, did you want to continue your questioning with this?
No, that's quite all right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Page 36 of your brief,
takes on this issue of the degree of permanence and embraces the dissent, or one of the dissenting opinions in Roberts. Roberts had a brilliant majority opinion. I say tongue-in-cheek, of course, because I wrote it. You may disagree with the brilliance. But there were also very vigorous dissents. And so you're embracing the dissent and getting rid of the degree of permanence is what I hear also from questions from this bench who were part of the dissent in Roberts. What cases would we have to overrule besides Roberts if we got rid of the degree of permanence?
If page 36 spoke of the court's need to overrule anything, I think it would be an overstatement.
No, it did not speak of overruling it, but instead, it didn't use the word overruling. Instead, it embraced Justice Prosser's dissent. As Justice Prosser explained, it's very doubtful that the Seventh Circuit intended to create a degree of permanence test for occupants. Citing 105 of his opinion, Justice Prosser concluded that our Court of Appeals should not have embraced the phrase degree of permanence as established in Wisconsin law to bootstrap its decision in Doan. And despite Justice Prosser's warning and his opinion in Roberts, here we are with a degree of permanence. Now, you didn't say overrule, but I think it isn't required when you say you're embracing Justice Prosser's dissent, which is fine, but I'm just asking you, what cases will we have to overrule if we get rid of the degree of permanence?
The degree of permanency test came in by this court with the recent Roberts case. There's a couple of appellate court cases that mentioned the Snow Eagles case that referenced the New Jersey case that was not adopted, contrary to respondents' argument. It was rejected. The degree of permanency test was rejected in Snow Eagles. Yet, if I could say like a bad penny, the language found its way into some other decisions. I think Lou and maybe Held.
And maybe Doan.
Yeah, it sort of crept in there as a judicial gloss that we contend has no true place in the statute. So the degree of permanency test, as applied, first of all, I feel we meet, as the trial court said. Secondly, is not a real firm precedent. And in fact, it came rather to the court rather circuitously, as Justice Prosser pointed out. So we don't need to overrule it, but we do need to see it for what it is and recognize as well that the degree of permanence test, again, concludes by saying as opposed to mere use. So it's a broader definition in that sense if applied and easily met by what Creekside's purpose was at the scene. If I may, in my replies, to start with Justice Abrahamson, to correct something, even to a degree of an apology, we do not quarrel with the contract. And to the extent I mentioned it was an April contract, it is Exhibit 10, as I said, and it is a plaintiff appellant at that time in the appeals court, number 160, Exhibit 10. And it is a February 7th contract, and it does speak at paragraph 6 to overhanging shoreline path-type trees.
East and west.
Directed to.
Both.
To deal with.
Mm-hmm. So for, you know, I read the trial court opinion and the counsel's argument to the trial court. But the problem is that it doesn't set forth a standard, I think, that can be applied in other cases. And when this court's going to write an opinion, it is somehow going to have to set a standard or a definition of the statutory terms agent
and occupier. And it would be very helpful if the trial court had set that kind of standard, but what it says is that it's not an agent. That it is an agent, and that they're going to construe occupiers like the snowmobile trail group, and that although independent contractors aren't employees, they could be agents, and that that they fall within the agency definition, and therefore they're going to hold for you. That's what the trial court said, but I don't get from that, and maybe you can give it, something that's going to be a standard for other cases.
Yes, I'll address it by the particular words of the statute at issue and then the policy behind it.
Okay.
And that is to say that broadly considered and liberally interpreted, agents engaged in the maintenance of land for recreational uses are protected. Landowners, title owners, should be encouraged to use specialists efficiently in order to carry out jobs for which they have no employees who directly do that kind of work, like a tree service, like a mason, an electrician. Therefore, the standard this court should adopt is entirely consistent with what the legislature intended, and that is to encourage title landowners to maintain their property, which Conference Point desired to do, to keep it open to the public, and do that in this particular case by avoiding trees blocking the path. So it is entirely consistent to adopt that standard because that's what the legislature intended.
That's the policy.
Thank
to
you,
keep
you
it
counsel.
Open.
I'm going to be an equal opportunity red light offender enforcer. So thank you very much for your commentary.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your arguments. We will be back for the third case of the day at 1:30.